to get to that success, you've navigated a bunch of different pitfalls. You start to figure out that there is a way to do it again and to do it well. With each attempt, you get stronger, you get better, you're fitter, you're able to sort of navigate across the sort of normal pitfalls.
As an employer, your business depends on your staff. They are the backbone of your company. But because you face unique challenges managing your team, you need to have the right resources. On this podcast, industry expert Alex Atwood tackles it all so you don't have to.
On today's podcast, I'm going to be talking to rockstar serial entrepreneur AC Chakrabarty. If you haven't heard of AC, well, I'll give you a little bit of his bio. He co-founded two companies that he exited before the age of 45. He's currently the CEO of a company called Higher Logic, and they are doing very cool, disruptive stuff with AI and with hiring technology. So super relevant these days. And personally, I have benefited from AC's wisdom. He is a heart-led leader. He serves on my board of directors for my company, Gravywork. And I think you'll get a lot of very cool information and you may learn something. So enjoy the podcast. You're an entrepreneur. You're somebody that has mentored many, including myself, and you're on my board. And I really want to understand, for those out there that are listening to this, you and I went to college together. You then went to work for Price Waterhouse, right?
Yeah, I did.
Initially, yeah, as a consultant, which is almost the path that 90% of the George Mason students took, leaving at that time in the late 90s or the mid 90s or whenever we graduated. So did you always have the inkling to be an entrepreneur? And like, what made you make that jump?
Thanks for having me today. But one of my earliest memories about entrepreneurship is I was maybe 7 years old and we had just come back from a trip in London. And that was my first experience of walking into a grocery store. And I was just amazed at, wow, you walk through aisles with carts. And then here I came back to my home, which was in Calcutta, India. And there was no such thing as a grocery store, right? You just have like a big market. And I said to my mother that, you know what? We could create the first grocery store and it would be revolutionary here. Just take that principle. And that's one of my earliest memories. And I think I've always seen the world through a lens of opportunity. I always seen the world as what's possible, what market is unserved, what could I create? That is kind of, I guess, part of my nature, personality, and DNA. And longer term, over university and the work environment, I took that more towards technology because kind of that was my not quite passion, I would say, but the biggest market opportunity. And I had a kind of a desire and a liking for it.
Very interesting. So let's talk a little bit about that. So you are you're not a first generation. You actually came over. How old were you when you came from India?
I'm actually a first generation immigrant. So I was probably about maybe 10 years old when we first came to the United States. My father had come to do his master's. Then we went back and I spent some of my formative years living in India and then came back because I guess when my parents looked at what was going on within India at the time, there was really not a lot of scope for careers in the future. And they felt it was, given the fact that I already had a green card, that the opportunity was bigger for me in the United States, especially for the kind of person I was. So I kind of came back in my late teens. So but I still consider myself an immigrant.
Were you able to speak fluent English when you moved to the US?
No, I wasn't. So I had to do the normal ESL thing that all, and I don't know if that's still around, I'm assuming it is, but the program where English is a second language and you pick it up. But I did have a knack for learning languages anyway. And so it didn't take me long to lose that sort of foreign accent, the strong foreign accent.
So what challenges did you find when you were in this country and you didn't speak the language? Did you find yourself starting to build a community of other people from India, or did you find yourself assimilating with the Americans in your classes?
I think from a very early age, I liked playing sports. So I would find myself mixing with kids who are playing pickup soccer. Soccer was what I kind of knew because I came from India. That's the one sport that we played everywhere. So I was able to sort of make friends through sports. And that was my way of integrating. And what's interesting is most of the community that we had moved into were also a community of immigrants. So think of them as a lot of Asians from Korea, a lot of Persians, a lot of Latino sort of background people, and not kind of the affluent zip code, if you will. So therefore, we were all playing pickup sports together and making friends from different parts of the world.
Mm. What a unique perspective of the West and America when you come in with others from all over the world and you start to build your own sort of community of first generation Americans. And that resonates with me. As a matter of fact, our friends in college, they were all in one way or another. I think the majority of them. I don't remember anyone who wasn't a first generation in our little group. Yeah, so, okay, well, let's get back. So you graduated from school. You've been an athlete playing sports. And here you are at Price Waterhouse. What sort of fundamentals, if any, did you learn working as a consultant at Price Waterhouse? And I'm not really pointing just at technical type of knowledge, but anything just in terms of relating to others, in terms of building networks, anything like that?
Yeah, I think one of the wonderful things about what I would call the tier one consulting firms is it's a great training environment for soft skills, the things that you're not taught as a skill at a university level. And one of the things that Price Waterhouse, at least back then, had a really good structure around was sending young recruits that just joined the firm to get indoctrinated into the philosophy of how do you become a servant to your clients? How do you think deeply? How do you solve problems? How do you work with teams that come together and represent the value of the company? That was, for me, one part of really good structured learning. It gave me poise. It gave me the skills to present in front of people in a business manner, not sort of delivering a technical presentation, but actually stating what a solution to a problem might be. And the second thing that I got out of working there was, again, softer skills around client management and looking at sort of working within bigger client organizations, the politics around it, things that you just don't learn in school, and the ability to look at really savvy partner level Pricewaterhouse people that were just elegant and sophisticated in how they navigated and managed all that stuff. That's a skill that I think was really invaluable in working there.
So working within teams and managing projects and then understanding what goes into being a polished executive, right? And anything around that. So there are many that get into a, you can call a comfortable situation like a Price Waterhouse, who take either the corporate ladder, they learn, they move, and they go in that direction. You decided that that sort of security wasn't for you. So when you decided to take on the role of the entrepreneur and found your first business, what things showed up that were unexpected? What unexpected challenges did you face?
There's an old saying that ignorance is bliss. And in the way that I was going through Price Waterhouse, I think I was indoctrinated into a mode of thinking that said, for me, the trajectory was to become a partner someday and then open up a line of business at Price Waterhouse. And it was around the time when the internet was actually booming. And I didn't know anything about it. And that's where the ignorance is bliss. I didn't understand there was such thing as you could create an internet company and own a big chunk of it, and that can someday IPO or get acquired by other companies, and massive amounts of wealth could be created. I had no idea. And so I didn't even know what a stock option was at the time. And so therefore, to me, I lived in a bubble, if you will, this consulting bubble. But at the same time, the boom was taking place, right? And amazing tech companies were being created and launched and growing. And I had the opportunity to leave Price Waterhouse to join a company called Siebel Systems, which was very young in the CRM space that predated Salesforce, which most people know today. But Siebel sort of created CRM. And it was a place where I think I got the sort of entrepreneurial tech foundation pieces in place, where we learned about understanding gaps in the market, building products, designing products, working with engineering, taking software to market, and how do you build and sell and scale a software business. So I picked up some of those essential learnings, like many of my peers and cohorts back then at Siebel, which was a great place to learn. That gave me the fundamental pieces coupled with everything that I had learned in school and at Price Waterhouse to go start my own software company.
Mm. Got it. So when you went out on your own, what did you run into that you didn't expect as an entrepreneur?
I think the hardest thing that as a first-time entrepreneur that I didn't expect is how hard it was to actually go to market. It's easier to sort of look at something that's missing in the market and define it and say, okay, let's go build it. The hardest part is actually taking something to market and scaling it. Mm. And how do you convince a sales guy that's never heard of you and can go sell anything for anyone? Why would he work with you? Why would he take, even for equity or some other financial incentive, to work with your company to sell your product? I think that was the hardest learning for me personally. Mm.
I see. And so did you develop that in real time as you were building the business? You began to understand how the product fit into the market and develop yourself as a leader to be able to evangelize that? Yeah.
I remember picking up the phone and just calling customers. So for example, I would call the head sustainability person at General Motors. She picked up the phone and I said, hey, this is what I'm doing. I'm measuring energy with my software. I'm going to tell you about your carbon emissions and all that kind of stuff. And for the one person that picked up, maybe 50 hung up and said, don't ever call me again. But in going through that process, I kind of threw myself into this uncomfortable position. And by the way, I was coming from Pricewaterhouse, where everyone picks up your call, right? And from a brand and then an established business here, you didn't have a brand. You were nothing. No one heard of you. You're just an annoyance taking up someone's time. But that taught me a lot about how the messaging could be refined for the product that we were building. Because for the conversations that did happen where people didn't hang up, I was able to sort of glean from it what resonated and made the sales pitch better and better and better. And that made a big difference.
Yeah. So you started a software company thinking that you were going to be serving a particular market, correct? And then you quickly learned that there was a heavy lift in taking whatever it was that you thought you were going to be able to sell into a market and actually selling it into the market, right? So how did the product actually change to fit the market?
It changed pretty significantly from a technology perspective. Initially, we had a huge idea of this gigantic platform that does everything. Because one of the things I've realized is you put a few smart people in a room and I'll give them a whiteboard, they can come up with a big vision. But how you chop that up and align it with what customers need, which you would call product market fit, is a whole other challenge. Mm-hmm. And I think we took our big platform idea, and as we listened to what customers were doing, the systems they were using, the processes that they had, what was realistic and unrealistic to slot in, it changed the definition of what our ultimate software was that we ended up actually transacting and selling in the market. And yeah, so that sort of chiseled the clay, if you will, and defined the final product. Mm-hmm. But I would call it going through a series of little pivots.
And so how many years did you go through that journey with your first software company?
It was about just under four. So it's about 3 years.
About 3 years.
Yeah, three years, and which is considered pretty fast.
Oh, absolutely. And so within 3 years, you were able to find a buyer and actually exit the business. So what did that look like? Was that something that you had initially from the start determined that, okay, this thing is going to be built to sell quickly? Or was this something that just sort of showed up in the course of doing business?
I think we always build a business to have it exit. I had no idea it would happen that quickly. And I think in my particular example, there was a set of circumstances that came together that sped up the acquisition, which is around 2011, the housing market had collapsed and there was a lot of uncertainty in the macro level at the economy. And investors were sort of moving away from putting money into venture capital firms were hesitant to put money into startups. And here I was as a startup where I needed longer term capital to kind of grow the business. And I looked at a world around me that was collapsing, right? So for example, one day you get up and Merrill Lynch is gone and Bank of America just took it over. It was that kind of craziness that was happening. And in that time of uncertainty, a buyer shows up with appreciable good value that's going to return huge amounts of dollars to the co-founders, to investors. And when we looked at the deal, it just made sense at the time to take it, especially because of the uncertainty that we were all living in at the time. I think for me, that was a separate thing than a strategic timing to exit the market.
Right. So it was not actively for sale.
No, it was not actively for sale. But I think of all the stories, it was, and this is part of life. Sometimes you have to acknowledge the fact that sometimes luck is on your side. Sometimes it isn't. That's just how things work. For me, it worked out that way, that luck was on my side, but it gave me a really strong view into all the things that can go wrong when you're doing a startup. And that list is just really long. Mm-hmm. For every startup that does exit, there's probably thousands of startups that fail.
Yeah. So that, to most startup founders, is always the goal to exit. So there you were, 3 years into your first company, and suddenly you have an exit. Someone wrote you a check. How does that feel?
I think it's unreal. And recently, I'll tell you, this week I had coffee with a friend of mine that just went through his first exit. And it still hasn't sunk into him, because I think there's few things. I think cerebrally, you understand that, of course, financially, you're wealthier than you were ever imagined you would be, which is nice. But more importantly, you carry so much tension and stress and anxiety in building a startup that you get used to that on a day-to-day basis. And one day it's gone, right? Because you've exited, and it takes time for that to sink in. But overall, I think it really sunk in maybe 3 months after the deal was actually done. That you could actually take a breath and say, okay, I think this is done. Next chapter should be open.
So how long of a breath did you take?
So we worked for the acquired company for about 2 years, mm-hmm. and kind of fulfilled our obligations as professionals, made sure our network was intact, never burned a bridge, and then started another company.
So tell me about that. Was that always in the planning that, hey, this is something we're going to do again? Or was it something that...
I think when you do it once and you're successful, and you've kind of, to get to that success, you've navigated a bunch of different pitfalls. Mm-hmm. You start to look at patterns and you start to figure out that there is a way to do it again and to do it well, knowing that there's always risk, knowing that there's always a chance of failure. But with each attempt, you get stronger, you get better, you're fitter, you're able to sort of navigate across the sort of normal pitfalls. I'll give you an example. When you start a company and you're kind of wrestling with this, how do I take it to market? Everyone looks like a partner, which could be a total waste of time for you because you're partnering with the guy down the road to a gigantic company. And one of the things you learn is, hey, you have to really think about who the ideal partner is and spend time creating value around that relationship so that they're incented to take you to market. Like, those are things you learn as you do something the second or third time, is you learn where to spend your time and where not to.
Yes. So you've started your second business. And so that was a different learning experience, I assume. And from what I hear, you learned from the first business and you took that into the second business. So what exactly did you put in place for the second business? And then what happened there?
For the second business, I think what we put in place that was better is aligning the problem statement of what we were trying to solve technologically, a better engineering team that would deliver what I would call a market leading product. And here's the thing. This is a great example of where we aligned the technology, recruited a phenomenal team, raised a lot of capital. So everything was great. And I would say, if you look back at our customers, and this is a business called AnyPresence, we had everyone from the world's top banks in MasterCard, the world's largest hospitals, amazing retail brands like Brooks Brothers, GE as customers, just amazing enterprise customers. But having said all that, yet again, I found myself at a juncture where investment of growth capital started to change in that segment, where I'd got a great venture, but I didn't have enough growth capital. And there was a bet that we placed around one corporate entity, aligned ourselves with that company and said, look, that's going to be our distribution channel, and put all our eggs in that basket and said, we're not going to raise a lot of capital. We're just going to grow through tight collaboration and eventually an exit to this other large software company. Well, that particular software company got taken over through an activist investor, and they started shutting all the deals down. So suddenly we found ourselves in a scenario where we were underfunded and our go-to-market was capped off. So learning there for us was we put all of our distribution eggs in one basket and took a unidimensional risk that I don't think anyone foresaw that particular company getting taken over that fast through activist investors. But anyway, we learned from that. We were able to kind of sell that business to private equity, nowhere near the sort of amazing, you know, value that we had created, but it was still an exit and we still made money from it. And overall, it was a great story. But the learning there was, here was a company that had the potential to get a $1 billion exit, but got a fraction of that because just misfortune, miscalculation in the market.
So very valuable learning there. Got it. So now you find yourself working for the second acquirer, right? And how long did you work for them, or are you still working for them?
No, I'm not working for them. My work for them did pretty well. So now I'm CEO of a company called HireLogic, which is essentially a platform that helps you structure how you hire people into the company so that it's apples and apples. Everyone asks the same questions. It's perfectly aligned with the modern world of remote teams, hiring people from all parts of the world, and just making sure that quality and a cultural fit is not being dislocated as a function of people joining the company from remote locations. So again, it's in software. I'm working with really good individual investors, learning a lot. And my responsibility here is to really build HireLogic into what I would call a unicorn level status, which I think it has the potential to do, primarily because we're able to inject a lot of AI related technologies into the platform.
So this is a different scenario for you.
Totally different scenario. It takes me back to more of the application software space, like back in Siebel days. It's not difficult to understand. It's really about a platform that helps you hire people and interview people, and AI helps you come up with the decision support system to pick the right candidate, one over the other.
Has the relationship that companies have with their customers, have you seen that evolve either over your career or through the different companies that you've worked for, including HireLogic?
I think yes. I think that if I look at, especially after the pandemic, I think things have definitely changed. Things have changed in the sense, at least from my perspective, customers are in a way far more discerning about where they spend their time. And sometimes in a good way, because I'm actually speaking with customers that are willing to look at much smaller vendors and smaller companies, but instead of taking a chance, they actually want to implement and do pilots and get their hands dirty in terms of working with the software, but they're much more open-minded, which is interesting. And I think the sales model has changed significantly since the pandemic, because the big rep from Oracle doesn't really show up anymore. And the deals have been deconstructed, I would say, to a good degree.
Yeah, different sales process. And working in a company that's primary focus is hiring and people-based. And have you found that the way that hiring and the qualities that you look for in a new member of a team have changed at all? Are there certain things that are now more important that you found that your customers are looking for?
Yeah, I mean, I think customers are looking for a better cultural fit. If you look at the hiring world, there's a lot of personality tests and things like that that have been around for a very long time, which talks, I think, a lot about what an individual is about, which is fine. But I think what companies really care about more is how do they fit within the team? So it's not you and your persona, but it's the team's culture. And then looking at a candidate and looking at their choices and their predispositions of how they might behave vis-a-vis your team's culture. And it's really about getting out of a candidate their preferences of where the type of environment they want to work in. And there's no right or wrong. You might have a candidate that's more analytical, that wants more data before they make decisions, whereas the culture in your team is really about speed and refining it over time as opposed to overanalysis. So you might have a great candidate with all the right skills, but culturally, they're not going to move as fast as you want them to move. So therefore, these types of things that I think companies are more concerned with than ever before. But in general, look, there is a huge shortage of qualified people, especially after the pandemic. And in tech, it's really tough to hire. Those are my observations.
That's very insightful. And what I found in the post-pandemic world is exactly that. I think that the peer-to-peer relationships within the workplace suffered somewhat. And it gave rise to a more sort of an individualistic way and of being for employees, not necessarily in companies that I've run, but from what I've seen, just sort of out there in this world. And I had a conversation with and read a book by a good friend of mine named Keith Ferrazzi. And the name of his book is called Leading Without Authority. And what he says in that book is that really the fundamental role of a leader is to foster peer-to-peer relationships, is to be what he called a humble Sherpa of your team. So your job is really just to foster the health of the team as a whole, and doing that by building authentic relationships with members of the team. And after that conversation, it really dawned on me that that is sort of a universal sort of cultural thing that people relate to. And what I mean by that is when you have a true relationship with people on your team, you really get to understand what opportunities lie in for them in their world as a result of being part of your team. So more than just how they can benefit the team as a whole, but what are they actually going to get in their lives as a result of it? And I think when you have that, then you have people that are self-motivated and just naturally they become a cultural fit. If so, if they are a cultural fit, in other words, like natural selection type of thing. If it's not a fit, they'll go find a good fit. But at the end of the day, they'll be able to serve your company from a more authentic, sort of heart-driven place where they'll actually be part of the mission as opposed to buying into the mission, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. I think a lot of times as managers, you're classically trained to look at output and say, okay, how do I get the highest quality output so that I've got the most competitive product or the most competitive service or whatever it is? And you spend a lot of time solving for recruiting people that on paper seem like they're going to create that perfect output. But then as you bring them into the team, you realize that how much synergy and how important synergy is to drive that output, even more so than the skills a person brings, because you can tap, as you were pointing out, their emotional connection, their sense of mission, if you will, into whatever you're trying to achieve. And just enrolling them into that process is tough. And it takes skill, it takes art, it takes effort to find that right match.
Absolutely. It takes authenticity. Yeah. Oh, well, this is great. I want to ask you, so when you were younger, what do you wish you knew then that you know now? Is there anything that could have, some sort of insight that you've gotten here where you are today that would have really served you at a
young age? Yeah, like for example, if I could go back, I would tell my younger self to find a better balance between pursuit of whatever is important at that stage. At a school age, it could be grades, at work-wise, it could be the next promotion or whatever, to enjoying some of the fundamental basic things in life, like traveling, spending quality time with people that you want to be around, those types of things. That's one. The second thing is the importance of the mind-body connection. So in other words, the relationship between having peace of mind, a healthy body, eating right, exercising, and also balancing that out with work and finding that equilibrium sooner.
Okay. Well, I think there will be a part two. Absolutely. There'll be a part three and four. So thank you so much for joining. This is a beautiful conversation, great call. And I look forward to many years with more conversations like
Absolutely.
That.
See you soon. Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to Off the Clock. Don't miss next week's tips around innovation and HR. Subscribe to the show. You can catch us on YouTube, Apple, iHeart, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts. Until next time, be kind and thrive.